From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. 3 years ago this day, Flint was switched from Detroit drinking water to the Flint River. How has the state responded to the disaster?
Their tactic previously was to deny, deny, deny. Now the tactic is to delay, delay, delay.
We hear from frustrated residents.
No one's going to, you know, sit here and roll over while there's poison still coming from the tap.
And from the Flint school superintendent.
Our children are remaining focused because our leaders and our teachers are remaining focused.
And the Flint River, cleaner than you'd expect.
When we take people out on the river for the first time, I can win a bet every time to say that the first thing they're going to say when they come off the river is, I had no idea it was so beautiful.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. 3 years ago this day, Flint's drinking water was switched over from Detroit water to the Flint River. That fateful decision made in the name of cost cutting led to one of the worst environmental disasters in our state's and nation's history. All this hour, we'll explore the impact that water switch has had on the community. We begin by hearing from a few Flint residents about how they're feeling today.
I'm paying almost $200 water bills for water that's breaking out the children. That is, we can't use, and I don't think that it's fair that we're not really getting any answers to what's going on.
Every time I see things being done around the city, you know, I get excited because I say, well, you know, we might be suffering from the water, but we're getting some new roads. We're getting some new stoplights. You know, every time I see one more cop than I did yesterday, I get excited. You know, I've been in law enforcement for 15 years, so whatever help that we can get to keep down confusion in our city is going to make us look better as a community.
It wasn't just people living in the city that were hurt by Flint's water crisis. Businesses in the Vehicle City also suffered. Michigan Radio's Steve Carmody reports.
Why you on 73?
A group of four-year-olds is standing in a ragged line outside the Sunny Patch Learning Center. They're waiting impatiently for their teacher to say,
get ready, get set, go.
With that, the kids race to the other end of the parking lot behind the daycare center, where Annette Hughes is standing. She and her husband opened Sunny Patch more than a decade ago on Flint's north side. She says it can be an up-and-down business, but during the water crisis, it was definitely down.
It was a roller coaster. You know, my business was steady, and then for a minute, the enrollment dropped. And then after all the resources started coming in, business picked back up. It's just been up and down. And right now we're on the upside, but it has been a challenge.
Annette Hughes is hardly alone. Many Flint businesses saw their profits dry up as the water crisis made people question whether it was safe to spend time and money in the city. All kinds of businesses felt the pain, but maybe none more than Flint's restaurants. The Empress of China's Mandarin cuisine has been a staple on Dort Highway on Flint's south side for nearly 30 years.
And each dish we do is cooked in the wok, individually.
Ying Wang owns the restaurant. He proudly shows me around the kitchen. The large wok steam as cooks prep the food for the day. Yang is also proud of something else in the kitchen, all the new pipes he's installed.
So you go around the restaurant, the restroom, bathroom, everywhere.
Yang owns this building outright. He says that's why he's been able to afford to replace the pipes and put in a new water filtration system. He won't say how much all that cost, but he likes to tell his customers about the investment. Still, it's been tough.
I can pretty much say I was losing money. I remember the nights, like all my workers and servers just sitting there doing nothing. And it never happened like that for 30 years.
Lin Yang says his family's three-decade-old restaurant is only now stabilizing after taking a big hit from the water crisis. Not every business owner can say the same.
There are a couple of businesses that I know of that closed, and I believe you can attribute that to some of the things that went awry relative to the water.
That's George Wilkinson with the Flint Genesee County Chamber of Commerce. He says there's no definitive list of Flint businesses that went under during the water crisis, but Wilkinson is bullish on Flint's current business climate. He points to recent announcements of dozens of new manufacturing and call center jobs in town, something he connects to Flint's recovery from the water crisis.
One man's trash is another man's treasure, and we have seen those who would didn't want to run from the problem but run to it.
Back at Sunny Patch Learning Center, Annette and Samuel Hughes are making plans to expand. They've acquired some land next to their present location. But Annette Hughes says she's still ambivalent about keeping their daycare business in Flint.
I do and I don't. I do. I don't.
I think what frustrates her the most is that she don't feel that there's support to revitalize the community as a whole, even outside of the water crisis. The water crisis just seemed like it has brought everything to light.
Business owners say Flint needs tax breaks and incentives to lure new businesses and investment. They also want to see more people coming from outside to spend money in Flint. For Stateside, I'm Steve Carmody.
In addition to the human errors and incompetence from the likes of the Snyder administration, the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality and other departments, the EPA, and a series of unelected emergency managers, many have pointed fingers at another non-human culprit, the Flint River itself. But Rebecca Fedewa says, hold up, not so fast. Rebecca is the executive director of the Flint River Watershed Coalition and vice chair of the Flint River Corridor Alliance. I spoke with her in Flint this past Saturday at our live broadcast at the Flint Institute of Arts, and I asked her, did the Flint River get an unfairly bad rap in this water disaster?
It sure did, yes. We have a river that has suffered from a bad reputation for many, many years anyway. And when this crisis hit, we saw a whole lot of blame at the local, state, and national level in the press and the experts saying that, you know, that we have this toxic river and it was such a folly of a decision to make that switch to using the Flint River. But we know with the data that we collect over the years that we have a fantastic river system. It is fully supporting of all aquatic life, and we were confident that the river could serve as a quality drinking water source.
How did that narrative take hold and take over then?
I think it's the history that the river has. The river does not look that great as it flows through downtown Flint. We have an industrial history and a legacy of pollution in the river. But that pretty much was addressed with the advent of the Clean Water Act. That reputation just kind of stuck. And so it was really easy for people to grab onto that narrative and say that not only were there issues with the treatment and the agencies following up, but it was just a bad decision to switch to the river, which, again, we know that wasn't. It may have been a bad decision because they weren't ready to treat river water, but the river was fully capable of serving as that source.
How does the health of the Flint River compare to other rivers around Michigan, especially those that are near big cities?
It's comparable. Mm-hmm. So we know that, you know, urban rivers all face some of the same issues as far as stormwater runoff, the urban and industrial legacy that a lot of our rivers face. All rivers across the country have to deal with what's called non-point source pollution. So it's really comparable. We know there's a couple of hot spots in the river, one of them being right in downtown Flint that is about to be cleaned up. But otherwise, we have just a fabulous river. It's 142 miles. It flows through five different counties, and it's just, you don't have to go up north. No offense to our colleagues up north, but you know, you don't have to go up north for that wonderful river experience. You can have it right here.
And I know you really want people to understand that they shouldn't base their impressions of the Flint River on that part that runs right through the city because it's so channelized?
Right, it is. It was channelized by the Army Corps of Engineers.
Explain what that means.
Instead of a free-flowing river, we have a dam and about a mile and a half stretch of the river that was put into a concrete channel. One big section of it, we have horizontal concrete walls going about 15 feet down, so it's really dangerous. If you happen to fall into the river, it's hard to get back out again. And then it moves into was a former GM industrial site where, again, it's channelized, but then we have more of an angle on the bank, so you can actually get in and out of the river. But still, it's inaccessible. It's not attractive. Again, it proves a very large safety hazard for the residents.
Tell us about the Flint Riverfront Restoration Plan.
Yes.
What are people going to see?
Oh, this is fantastic. So we're going to be removing the Hamilton Dam right in downtown Flint, which is on the U of M Flint campus. And then there'll be a series of drops and pools that are created so that people can have a fun experience going up and down the river in kayaks and tubes and stand-up paddle boards. And then we're also going to be softening the edges of the river so that people can actually get to the river. It's a really interesting thing that we see in the springtime when we have the river come up, as it does with all the spring rains that we have. The river goes over those 15-foot banks at that point, and people flock to it. It's just such an interesting thing to see. We know that people like to be able to get to the river, to touch it and to interact with it and play and fish and everything else. And so this project is going to make that possible year-round and make it safe for everybody.
And what's the timeline?
That's always a good question. The project has been turned over to the Genesee County Parks and Recreation Commission, and they've been working so hard getting all the funding for that project, as well as moving downstream into the Chevy Commons area. So they're doing a really good job on that. I think they have all of the permitting for the removal of the dam. There's just some additional permitting that needs to be happening. The cleanup of the consumer site just above the dam is going to start any day now. Once that's done, they can start taking out the dam.
And how is this related to the upcoming dredging project that's supposed to start next month?
Right, yeah. So that's the consumer site.
Okay.
They've already started clearing the banks of vegetation so that they can get down to the river. The actual work in the river is supposed to begin in the next week or so.
Doesn't the need for such a major dredging project to clear up contamination and warnings to expect foul odors...
Yeah.
Doesn't that suggest to people that the river is unhealthy? I mean, I guess I'm wondering, with warnings like that, can you blame people for feeling suspicious about the health of the river?
Sure, and that is one of the hot spots that I mentioned earlier. But the thing that we know is the contamination is in the sediments and in the ground at that site. So it doesn't impact the health of the river downstream from there. The problem is it's all of the sediments are being held up by the Hamilton Dam. It's a really bad dam, and so it needs to be cleaned up in case something happens to that dam so those sediments don't move downstream. But it's all contained within about a block stretch of the river.
If you, Rebecca, could get people to see the Flint River and think about it as you do, what would that look like? What words come to mind?
Oh, the Flint River is fantastic. We have a stretch that you can go for about 2.5 hours in a kayak, and you'll never even see a road. Like I said, it's just like going up north. We have an abundant array of wildlife. We've got eagles, osprey, deer, ducks, everything that you could imagine seeing along a river. We have one of the best walleye fisheries in the state, one of the best smallmouth bass fisheries. So the recreational opportunities are abundant. When we take people out on the river for the first time, I can win a bet every time to say that the first thing they're going to say when they come off the river is, "I had no idea it was so beautiful."
And that was Rebecca Fedewa with the Flint River Watershed Coalition. Much more to come. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Who is most vulnerable to lead poisoning in the city of Flint? Of course, it's the children. So we decided to check in with the Flint Community Schools to see how they're preparing for this challenge. At our live Flint show this past Saturday, I spoke with Bilal Tawab, who's superintendent of Flint's public schools, and I asked him, after all he's been through, how would he describe the state of the school district today?
We're moving forward. That's key. We're moving forward. Right now, we are putting systems in place so that we're able to meet the needs of all of our children. We're sort of dealing with an unknown. We don't truly know what will be the full impact of the water crisis, but we must be proactive. We must be ready to respond to all of our students' needs. So we really are focused on aligning our resources to best meet the needs of all of our children.
How would you say the children and their families are doing?
I would say that our children are remaining focused because our leaders and our teachers are remaining focused. I will say that I attended the town hall meeting this past week, and I was reminded that we're still a community that's hurting. There's still a long way to go, but I truly believe as it relates to children, it's really up to us as the adults to protect them, to keep them focused, to let them know they'll be okay. And that is our message to our children.
Setting the tone.
Exactly.
Setting the tone. How about the water in the schools? Are you using it?
No. So I would say today that all of our students are still receiving bottled water. I do want to thank the huge donations we received, not only locally, but across the state and across the nation. We have this huge donation from the Walmart Foundation, and they've been covering all of our libation needs. They make sure that water is delivered to each school weekly, and we will continue that effort until we see there's time to move in a different direction. Also, as it relates to preparing our kids' lunches, Sodexo Magic has put a system in place where our students' lunches are prepared with safe water.
You have mentioned in the past, Bilal, when you were talking about the impact of the water situation, you wanted to see more early childhood options from 0 to 5 years old. What's happening on that front?
Now, that has been a wonderful sort of byproduct of this piece. As you may know, we reopened a closed school, Cummings, thanks to the support of multiple partners, one being the C.S. Mott Foundation in partnership with U of M Flint. And so now we are servicing kids over there, kids ages 0 to 4, 0 to 5. Also, you may know that the Mott Foundation is supporting the building of a new early childhood center on one of our campuses. Actually, we'll have an educare center opening here in November. Also, in partnership with the ISD, we're constantly increasing the number of early childhood opportunities in the city of Flint. My concern is that right now we're only tapping into about 40% of the children who could be in an early childhood option. So it's going to really take a community effort to tap into that additional 60% that we want to see in a classroom.
That's kind of the challenge ahead.
That is the challenge. And that's beyond Flint Community Schools. Like I said, that is a community effort. There are so many children who are just at home who really need to be in an early childhood option.
Is the space there?
The space is there. Come one, come all.
That's
but we want to make sure that all of our children are set up for success.
And you've also talked a lot about bringing in more behavioral support staff and increase in specialists like social workers and psychologists and speech pathologists. Where are you with that?
Yes, and so I do want to thank folks at the state level and also folks at the federal level who provided funding for additional social workers, counselors, speech pathologists, school psychologists in the district. I would say my greatest, not greatest challenge, but I will say the piece that sort of keeps me up at night as superintendent is the sustainability piece. You know, just how long will these resources, you know, how long will they be coming or be provided for the district? Because like I said, we're dealing with an unknown, you know, and so I really want to know there's a commitment for years to come for these resources. And I will say another challenge for us is, you know, now we have a good problem to have, just filling the positions now. You know, finding the talent to come into the district. So we have the positions, we have the funding. Now it's all about filling those positions and that sustainability piece.
Overall, Bilal, how would you characterize the support that you've gotten from Lansing, from state officials and from the legislature?
Well, I would say that support has been great. I do want to go back. The Cummings piece, there's a lot of state support in the reopening of Cummings. So I do want to thank our lieutenant governor who played a major role, our state superintendent who has played a major role in that work. Right now, the support is great, but my biggest question is now the sustainability piece, the long-term commitment.
Keeping the money coming.
Yes, indeed.
Because we're really looking at an unknown that's going to stretch into who knows how many years.
Exactly. And folks ask me, you know, what are you saying? One thing I will say, we have a huge influx of parents now who are requesting that their child is evaluated. We are definitely meeting that need. But like you stated, the long-term piece is truly an unknown for us.
You have some fierce competition in the Flint area from charters and from open enrollment. How do you sell Flint Community Schools? What's your pitch?
You're right. There are about 15,000 school-age kids in the city of Flint. We only have a third of that market share, about 5,000. We have about 5,000 who are currently in charters, and about 5,000 who have taken advantage of schools of choice. So yeah, we need to sell ourselves. Right now, our focus is on controlling the narrative. And so we're constantly pushing out positive stories. There's so many great things that are occurring in the school district. But one thing I will say, I just don't want to sell you something. I want you to be able to come into Flint Community Schools and truly see all the great things that we're doing. We're expanding athletics now. We're expanding art opportunities for our kids. And we have a laser-like focus on academics, and that is key. And I will say this, Flint Community Schools will have the system in place that will meet the needs of all kids. And so we're number one. We're going to be number one. I feel as if we're sort of awakening a sleeping giant. I mean, Flint Community Schools has a very storied past. And so I'm really happy to be leading this next chapter in Flint Community Schools.
Even as you're staring at the ceiling at night, just saying, worrying about sustaining all of the momentum and the money.
Yes.
Big challenge there.
Big challenge.
You do have one of the most challenging jobs of any school superintendent in the nation. I don't think anyone would argue with that. Well, just when you think about all of this, what gives you hope and optimism?
I, as superintendent, I do not feel as if I'm alone in this work. I have a community behind the school district. We have the strong philanthropic organizations here. We have the universities. We have the community who really wants to see this district return to its greatness. So I would say when I'm having a long day, and there are many of those, I do feel as if I can call someone and say, you know, I need some help here. Can you help? And folks are willing to respond. And so that is what keeps me encouraged. And at the end of the day, there are children here, and we have to do what's right for children. And so that drives the work, and to know I have a community behind me, that keeps me encouraged.
Bilal Tawab is the superintendent of Flint Schools. Thank you so much for being with us here on Stateside here in Flint. Thank you.
Thank you.
This water crisis brought such a steady stream of big names to Flint. We had Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump, certainly officials from Lansing, from the EPA. But they flew in and out of Flint. They were not living day in and day out with water that was poison. We want to talk about what that has been like with two different outcomes. One family stayed and one family made the tough choice to leave Flint. Laura McIntyre and her family are here, despite damage to their home and appliances and worries about their health. And Cameron Banks' parents saw changes in their kids' health, and when the door opened for her dad to attend grad school in Ann Arbor, they decided to head south on U.S. 23 and make a new home in Ann Arbor. Cameron Banks and Laura McIntyre, welcome to Stateside. Great to have you both with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Laura, I know we have talked to you on Stateside in the past about the water bills you were paying, and then the last time that we talked earlier this year, you decided to withhold payment. Where are things today with that?
Yeah, we're still withholding payment. Our bills are approximately $200 a month for water that we really can't use. And right now we are on the shutoff list, and we're getting increasingly aggressive and outright abusive letters from the city in terms of you know, trying to cajole us into paying for water.
And I know you kind of, I want you to kind of recap for us. When we talked before, you kind of spelled out the effects that water has had just in your home and on your family.
For my home, my home is pretty much destroyed. We have the pipes have disintegrated in the walls. The water streams down the walls. It's pretty much a wash. I do live in Mott Park, and it's an older home. At this point, it would take more to replace the pipes and put in a filtration system than the home is actually worth. We're just going to have to walk away from it at this point. Plus, anything that the water has touched, any appliances, we're on our third or fourth washing machine. It's just disgusting.
Cameron, how'd you feel about your family deciding to leave Flint and move to Ann Arbor?
Well, I believe that it was the best choice for our family, especially considering our health. My sisters and I were tested and had very high levels of lead in our bodies and in our hair, which is a sign of a long-term effect. And so it was definitely the right move for our family. Emotionally, it's been very difficult, but I wouldn't do anything differently if I had the chance.
Tell me, how has it been living in Ann Arbor and settling into Ann Arbor?
It has been such a pleasure. It's been a break. Everything is very clean. Everyone is very pleasant. There's just a very general vibe of health and happiness that you don't get to experience in Flint. And it's a luxury, really. It's so nice that when we come back, we almost feel down, like, you know, wow, this is how we used to live all the time. You know, living in Ann Arbor, we don't have to worry about simple basic rights like water. There's not always the urge to keep your guard up and feel like, you know, someone's trying to come after you or someone's trying to do something to you or harm you, which is very, very fatiguing. People in Genesee County have, like, the highest blood pressure levels. It's, like, ridiculous because they're just so stressed out.
I'm wondering what it was like to have this thing that you were living through being written about and talked about and shown to the world, and there you were right in the middle of that. What was that like for you, Laura?
Well, it was validating at first because it had taken so long to get the public aware of the extent of the atrocities that were being committed by our government. Feel vindicated that, you know, there's been attention, that I'm glad you came back because,
You know, it's 3 years, 4 years that we've been living on bottled water. You know, it still has not been addressed. The pipes have not been replaced. The situation is not fixed, and the water is getting worse.
What about you, Cameron? This was quite an education for you in watching news covering something that you knew very well.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like?
I agree that it was very validating, but it was also kind of made me feel like a fish in a glass bowl, because everyone wanted to know, you know, what do you think about the water? And I think at some point it kind of seemed like I was more of a spokesperson for the situation than I was a person that was actually living and breathing and bathing in and, you know, washing my clothes in with this water, which was, you know, very tiring. Still to this day, when people hear that I'm from Flint, the first question they ask is, you know, how's the water? It's like, poison.
And yet we aren't seeing Flint on the national news or the international news as much. And we hear declarations from the EPA that things are going within standards, quote unquote. And people might think, well, things are getting back to normal in Flint. And what do you say when you hear that?
I get pretty enraged because it's not true, and I think that people forget that the news only covers what's hot, and so they've already done all their crying and pleading about Flint. They're done with the situation until something bigger and better happens, and that's it for them. But there's still people living here. There's still people, you know, using 6 bottles of water to cook a pot of pasta, and it's enraging that people could, you know, dismiss that just because that's what the media is telling them. You would think that maybe there'd be a bit more humanity there.
How has this changed, or has this changed, the way you think about Flint?
It really has changed the way I think about Flint. When I think about, you know, my childhood and coming up, Flint is my home. And it's, you know, all I really know, all I'm really familiar with. But now, living in Ann Arbor, when I think about Flint, it's more like something I escaped. I kind of feel like a refugee, which I think is a very powerful thing to say, considering that, you know, there's still people here and it's not considered dangerous to anyone else, which is, you know, ridiculous. And I think that in my mind, I don't feel like there's much left for Flint. I feel like, you know, the people on the upper levels have really kind of left the people here just to their own devices. I mean, I don't want to say to die, but that's what's happening. And it's really heartbreaking because you don't want to think of your home as some place that can't be repaired, especially a place where you know that your grandparents and your friends and your teachers, all your loved ones still live as, like, you know, some wasteland. But that's what it seems like Flint is turning into.
And it's not that it can't be repaired. It absolutely can be repaired. It's not being repaired. And that's what's so frustrating is that there's just an absolute lack of humanity. Water is a human right. We're being told that water is not a human right. We're having our Great Lakes sold to Nestle for $200. It's right now the contract is up. They want to take out more of our Great Lakes water, and we're just giving it to them. You know, it's just infuriating. It's very, very frustrating.
What's the one thing we're talking to so much of the state when you're here on stateside? What's the most important thing that you want people elsewhere in Michigan to understand about the people who are here in Flint, about the people of Flint?
I would say that the people in Flint are resilient. You know, this isn't the first catastrophe our city has had, but you still see smiles. You still see, you know, kids having fun. You still see the programs that happen at schools and that happen downtown to try to attract people. People in Flint aren't going to be, you know, shut out so easily. The people are going to have to do a lot more than just ignore us to get people to be quiet. Because I know that no one's going to, you know, sit here and roll over while there's poison still coming from the tap. So I think that's the most important thing that people need to know about Flint.
And what about its people, Laura?
I would reiterate what she said. I think that we are strong, we are resilient. But we're fed up at this point. I mean, it's been 3-4 years. We demand an end to the emergency manager system. We demand that we be made whole again. We demand that we have medical coverage to take care of what's been done to us, to the poison, to the stress that's been done to us. we, you know, demand that it happen now. We're done waiting.
Cameron Banks, Laura McIntyre, thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And here are a few more Flint residents as they reflect on the past 3 years.
Well, we're a Flint family. All of us were born here. My mom was born here, and it's still a great place. I mean, this place is great, and there's a lot of good things about it. You know, it just, I think a lot of resolve is found here in Flint. I worked up in the Upper Peninsula, and I said Flint is a town of attitude, and that's not a bad thing.
Nobody's communicating with each other, and think it's like you want to appease us with a town hall meeting and things like that, but you're not really listening. You just want us to come have a venting session. So, yeah, it's a huge inconvenience.
I like Flint. Besides the water, I like Flint because this is a big city.
What else do you like about Flint?
That there's a bunch of places we can explore. And there's also like schools and places.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As we've been talking about this hour, it has been 3 years to the day since Flint's ill-fated switch to the Flint River as its source of drinking water. Then Mayor Dane Walling pushed the button that ended 50 years of getting water from Detroit. A bunch of city and state officials stood around toasting the occasion with glasses of river water. They promised people shouldn't notice any difference, said this is indeed the best choice for the city of Flint going forward. Kurt Guyette is an investigative reporter with the Michigan ACLU. He has covered the Flint water disaster from the very beginning, and he's written a very deep dive into the source of Flint's water crisis for the Metro Times. Good to have you with us, Kurt.
So great to be here.
Your piece for Metro Times tries to answer some very important questions. Why did Genesee County need to build a new pipeline that duplicated what was already being provided by a regional system? And how come officials, local and state, bent over backward to get Flint to be part of this KWA, the Carignani Water Authority, ending 50 years of getting water from Detroit? Did you find any clear answers to those central questions?
No, we didn't come to a conclusive answer, but the way you described it, it was absolutely accurate. I mean, they were bending over backwards. They were jumping through hoops. I mean, right now, the Attorney General's office is prosecuting people for using false pretenses to obtain the loan that was necessary for Flint to participate in the construction of the KWA. The fact that there was extraordinary efforts made to do this, possibly illegal actions were taken to do it, shows just how deep the effort was to make this happen regardless of the cost. One of the other things that came out in that article was the fact that it's being alleged that one of the stipulations of obtaining that loan was that Flint would have to use the river. So, you know, that conclusively draws a connection between the crisis in Flint and the Carignani pipeline.
And when we first heard, well, Detroit cut us off.
Yes.
We heard that from Lansing, from the highest levels.
Absolutely. And it was just absolute lie. No question about it. That was not true. You're absolutely right. I asked Governor Snyder's then spokeswoman, Sarah Werfel, about it. And that's what she said. Oh, we didn't have any choice in the matter. Detroit kicked us off. You know, they took something that was true, which was Detroit canceled a long-term contract, but then added something that was not true, which in the words of one of the emergency managers was Detroit said, go find your water someplace else. That's not true. Detroit kept making offers. First of all, they wanted to keep Flint on the system in general. But then once the decision to go with the Carignani was made, they wanted to keep selling water. And we were able to prove the lie by a Freedom of Information Act request document that we got, which was a letter signed by one of the emergency managers, Darnell Early, rejecting Detroit's offer. So there was no question that it was a lie, and there was no question that they kept repeating. Even after we proved it was a lie, they kept making the case, kept repeating the lie because they were stuck. They were the ones that made the decision, and they were doing everything they could to evade responsibility for that horribly tragic decision, to the point where they would tell a lie that was proved to be a lie. That's how desperate they were to avoid accountability for this.
Your Metro Times piece, Kurt, broke down two clear sides of this KWA question as you talked to Peter Hammer, Wayne State University Law and ACLU, and Jeff Wright, Genesee County Drain Commissioner and CEO of the KWA. Racism or trying to get Flint out from under rising Detroit water rates? Break that down more for us.
And there's various kinds of racism that Professor Hammer talked about. And really, the story was built around testimony to the Michigan Civil Rights Commission. Hammer presented a very long, thoughtful, well-documented testimony last June. Jeff Wright, the drain commissioner, came back with a response to that in November, really going after Hammer, very much attacking Hammer, whereas Wright was not really the subject of an attack in Hammer's initial testimony. And then Hammer responded pretty forcefully by coming back at Wright, getting into a lot of the issues. That testimony really did frame the two sides of the debate. The racism, certainly, there should be no debate that the structural racism that occurred, you know, the things that helped lead Flint to be in the position it is, it's undebatable. Federal subsidies for home loans weren't available to people of color. And so white people could move out of cities like Detroit and Flint, and black people were pretty much stuck. And then as the white flight occurred, it created kind of a downward spiral. You're losing your tax base, which causes a reduction in services, which causes more people to want to leave. You know, that aspect of the racism, I don't know how anybody could deny. It's so well established. It's just proved. But then Hammer goes further to say that continued racism sort of creates the opportunity to take advantage of these communities. Hammer didn't say it, but I would say it's not just racism, it's classism as well. And you see that throughout all the cities that were taken over by emergency managers. Almost all of them were majority minority cities, but they also all had in common very high poverty rates. These are communities that are marginalized for various reasons. You know, people ask, geez, would this have happened in Bloomfield Hills or Grosse Pointe? And the answer is clearly no. And the starting point is those cities don't get taken over by the state. You know, it's poor minority cities that get taken over the state. And one of the things that set these cities and school districts up for failure, but the cities specifically, were revenue sharing cuts. You had the issue of the crash in 08. So property values were decimated, and especially in communities of color, because the predatory mortgage industry targeted communities of color. So they were especially hard hit. And so their tax revenues take a really big hit. They're struggling just to make it. And then Snyder comes in and the revenue sharing, and it's like they're standing on the edge of a precipice and just got pushed over into this crisis. And then that justifies the state coming in and taking them over. And one of the things that they do is sell off their assets. Seeing this in a benevolent eye can be very difficult, especially for the people that have had this done to them.
When state officials, particularly the governor, at the beginning of 2016 had to kind of stand up and admit, yeah, we really, really blew it. Yeah. And there were all kinds of promises made at the start of 2016. So here we are almost a year and a half later. What's the tally? What has the state actually done for Flint and its people?
Well, I can speak to one thing that they're now going to do that is not voluntary, in that the ACLU of Michigan and the Natural Resources Defense Council brought a lawsuit, ended in a mediated settlement, but essentially now have the authority of a court guaranteeing that the promise that they are going to replace all the lead and galvanized service lines, that's going to happen. You know, previously there was a plan, but the people in charge of it said, well, we have a plan in place, but we don't have the guaranteed funding to make this happen. So that's one thing that is definitely going to be happening. But it is a mistake to think that that is going to solve the problem. There's problems with the damage done to plumbing with inside the homes on the one end of the service line. But then there's also the problem of the infrastructure in general, which is a huge problem, you know, the water mains. And it's a problem for a couple of reasons. I just heard last night at a meeting that because these water mains, which were also severely damaged as a result of using the corrosive river water without having the mandatory corrosion control treatment, Professor Mark Edwards from Virginia Tech, who played a key role in uncovering this, estimates that maybe a dozen years was taken off the life of the infrastructure, which is already old and in need of repair. What I heard at this meeting last night 50 to 60% of the water that's treated at the water treatment plant never makes it to someone's tap. It's lost through leakage. That's how what in bad shape the infrastructure is. So first of all, you have the cost of buying the water, treating the water, shipping the water that never gets there. And then that water ends up in the sewer system. So you're paying for it on the way out to treat it on the way out without ever having using it. That's one of the reasons that water rates for people of Flint are among the highest, if not the highest, in the country. The other thing is when those water mains break, that kind of shakes things up and then causes lead to get in. So it's a health issue there. The other thing is that the system is such overcapacity. It was built for a city of 200,000 people with a thriving auto industry. Now it's less than 100,000 people, and most of the auto industry is gone.
Right.
And so you have this huge delivery system without the customer base there. And so that water will sit there for days and days and days. And while it's sitting there, the chlorine dissipates, which allows the bacteria to thrive, which gets to the issue of Legionnaires, which was another consequence of switching to the river.
That killed people.
At least a dozen people, and probably many, many more. Bridge Magazine recently did a very, very good story showing there wasn't just a spike in Legionnaires' disease, there was also a spike in pneumonia, which the two can be confused. And so there's a very high likelihood, say probability, that there were cases of Legionnaires that were being misdiagnosed as pneumonia, and people were dying from pneumonia as well. And one of the reasons it was being misdiagnosed is because the warning was not being sounded about the spike in Legionnaires that was detected at the time and, again, is alleged to be part of the cover-up on the part of the state regarding all this.
Were you surprised, Kurt, when Merrick Weaver said she wants to keep the city with the Great Lakes Water Authority and not go to KWA?
I was surprised, very surprised, because last year the stance of the mayor was that I looked it into this, but these agreements, you can't get out of them. We're locked into it. And I thought that was that. And so it was surprising news. I think good news for the people of Flint in that they don't have to now go through another change in water source, very expensive change. Latest estimate is that it would cost more than $100 million to retrofit the water treatment plant to bring it up to speed to be able to treat the Lake Huron water, which is much less complicated to treat than the river water, which just shows you how inadequate the plan to treat the river water was. But we all know that prior to that initial changeover, the person running the water treatment plant said, if you do this change, it's going to be over my objections because this plant is not ready to do the job. But they were in such a rush to try to start saving money that they went ahead and did it anyhow. And as Professor Hammer stated, and we reported in our story, they could gamble with the lives of the people of Flint, and they did. And the people of Flint lost.
What's it going to take to keep Flint fatigue from setting in around the rest of the state? When you think of Lansing, you think of elsewhere, when they hear the EPA saying, well, you know, things are improving, use your water with filters. Oh, then how do you keep people from thinking, okay, then things are okay in Flint?
And this is the part of the story that gets missed, and it's unfortunate that it gets missed because it's so important and also so inspiring, which is that a lot of people get credit for helping uncover what was going on in terms of the lead. Mark Edwards from Virginia Tech,
Dr. Mona
Hanna-Tisha, they did crucial actions that helped bring this to people's attention. But the ground zero was the people of Flint themselves that refused to accept the lie that their water was safe. And they joined together and they fought and fought and fought and through their fighting found allies that helped them achieve their goal. Those people haven't gone away. They are still there raising hell about what's going on, about what their needs are. And so they're not stopping. It really is inspiring. It is too bad that crucial citizen role. Like when we were doing the test of the independent test of the water, that was a citizen-led test that did that. We helped coordinate. Edwards was providing direction, but it was the
people.
The people going out there, knocking on doors, collecting water samples, proving that it was done. I mentioned our documentary, Here's to Flint. A lot of that footage in that documentary is off of people's cell phones at meetings recording things that then they shared with us. So they were acting as citizen scientists. They were acting as citizen journalists. And
activists.
They were citizen activists. They brought the whole package together and caused this awareness to occur. And they are still there. There are class action lawsuits that are going on. I need to point this out because the schizophrenia involved, what's going on here, is incredible in that on the one hand, you have the Michigan Attorney General who is bringing criminal charges against the people alleged to have wrongdoing in all this. On the other hand, the same Attorney General is fighting tooth and nail these people in court. They fought us on our lawsuit. You know, they kept fighting until they couldn't fight anymore, and they eventually gave in. They are fighting now. We have a lawsuit that is attempting to get justice for the school children of Flint, saying that these kids have been damaged in a significant way. That damage doesn't go away, but what you can do is mitigate it through all kinds of services, all the support services necessary, all the wraparound services. And the state is fighting against that. They're fighting the class action lawsuit. I was at a meeting last night, a town hall meeting, the premier class action lawsuit involving Goodman Hurwitz, Pitt McGee, Trishelle Young, who is a lawyer up in Flint that has been in fighting this from the beginning just because she's a resident and saw a need and fulfilling it. They were talking about like motion after motion after motion being filed to just make their lives more difficult and delay. Like someone said last night, their tactic previously was to deny, deny, deny. Now the tactic is to delay, delay, delay. And justice delayed is justice denied. So they're up against that. And you have the Attorney General that is really right hand, left hand, completely at odds with each other and what they're doing. Here's another thing that is sadly ironic, which is the emergency managers that are being sued in this. The state law obligates the city of Flint to provide their defense. And so the city attorneys aren't defending them, but they're paying for their defense. And so you have the people of Flint paying to defend the people that they are suing in order to get compensation for the damage done to them. So there's a lot of bizarre aspects to this that become more and more bizarre as time goes on.
It makes your head hurt and your heart hurt, yes, as we mark this 3-year anniversary. Kurt Guyett, and you can find his terrific piece in the Metro Times, A Deep Dive into the Source of Flint's Water Crisis. Kurt's an investigative reporter with the Michigan ACLU. Thank you so very much.
Well, thanks so much for having me on and giving the attention that this issue deserves.
And let's end the show with a few more voices from Flint.
I didn't know it's been 3 years. It just seemed like yesterday.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
It's crazy. I didn't even know about it until, 2 years ago. So that's even scarier because we drink water like crazy, you know.
Even though we don't agree with it or like it, you know, we more or less have to cope with it right now because, you know, nothing has been done. When I say nothing has been done, I mean, obviously, you know, the water, you know, that we can go by and collect, whatever, that's something that's being done. You know, but I don't know if people are actually seeing the results fast enough. Because what we would ultimately like to see is the pipes fixed, the lead gone, and so we can resume back to our normal living. You know, showers, baths, you know, being able to run water out the sink.
It should have been taken care of by now. It should have been a wrap, done deal, moved on to the next thing. I mean, it's just been dragging on and dragging on. Fix it.
Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Peg Watson. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, Cass Adair, Lise Mesmer, and Nick Wallace. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.